Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I am proud to bring you Herculean Physique. Our topic is the Kings of Strength, and I'll be speaking with Bill Hinburn of Super Strength Training, the most appropriate person on the planet to be speaking to about this topic. Greetings and welcome, Bill. How are you?
Greetings. Doing very well. And you?
I'm doing well. It's so amazing. I was looking for someone to talk to about the book, The Kings of Strength. It's a remarkable book, although it doesn't really have all the strong men from ancient times to the present, but it has a great deal of them in there. And then I received your newsletter, and you started discussing the newsletter, and I said, I'll have this conversation with Bill.
So what? Well, that's good.
I'll explain a little bit about my background with this. When I was a kid, we used to go to Greece every summer. And Greece was very different from America in a variety of ways. And it wasn't just that the language was different or the culture was slightly different. It was radically different. It's like you were living in a different era when you visited Greece way back then, around 50, 60 years ago. And one of the things that they still had then that I hadn't encountered here was machistes, they were called, which you can call it combatants or fighters or warriors. And that's where they get the term machiste, by the way. So these machistes, they were different people, and they often took on names like Hercules and Samson and so forth. And they traveled around and performed amazing feats of strength. And the one legendary machistes was Panagis Koutalianos, who also called himself Hercules. And he was famous. There were songs written about him. I heard there were 32 of them. In all my years, I've only been able to find like two or maybe part of a third. But he was phenomenally famous. And then living at the time was Osamsons or Samson. And him, I actually got to talk to, and I talked to his wife. I wanted to be like the mighty Samson. And he told me that, no, it was very dangerous and not very easy life to wander around from town to town and island to island, butting sledgehammers to throw into the sky or pulling cars with their teeth and things like that. But anyway, I was very fortunate that I grew up with them. And just like the Peplum films have influenced me and the Peplum stars have influenced me, in my outlook and in my exercising and things like that, these mighty machistes, the mighty strongmen of old, also inspired me. And in Greek, they were called laiki iros, which means folk heroes, and they were treated as such. And now they're a thing of the past. Occasionally you hear of one or two still wandering around, but not like before when these men wandered the islands and the mainland, and they made legends for themselves that people still talk about to this day. So I've always tried to find ways of honoring them. On Facebook, I put up two shrines to the ones that directly crossed my path and influenced me. But there are many others. And in American bodybuilding, sometimes they were celebrated or talked about as like ancestors of modern bodybuilding. But not much is made of them these days, not as much as when I was a kid. But I always was interested in them, and when this book came out, I was very excited, and I'm still reading it. It's very weighty reading. It's not light reading, but I'm enjoying it a great deal.
That's interesting. I've heard of what we referred to or the English pronunciation in Masisti, but I've heard of them. I've seen pictures. There was a gentleman that that played the part in the silent movies. There was a movie by that name. But many of the different cultures, Greek, Roman, Chinese, Indian, they use a variety of different training appliances. And the sessions that they had, as far as old-time training, back around 1900, let's say, was as different back then as it is today. It just, a lot of it is just like diet. It's availability. You know, how did the old-time strongman eat? Well, availability once again. He didn't have the benefit or curse of preservatives. Okay.
Right.
And you know, vitamins weren't invented until the 30s. You know, I shouldn't say invented; probably discovered would be a better word. But regardless, you didn't have it. So you didn't have refrigeration until the 30s. So you know, everything prior to 1930, you know, is a game changer. And when the old timers trained, their sessions were long. You know, they could last half the day or all day. They would train for hours, and they would do basic lifts, you know, deadlifts, presses, bent presses, you know, stuff like that. I don't think anybody did a bench press. If they did, it certainly wasn't on purpose and didn't have a name. body weight exercises were a big deal, and of course, that would be a byproduct of acrobatics. Wrestling. Wrestling was probably the most popular sport. And strength training, you know, lifting weights, odd weights and odd objects, was really secondary. It was a means to an end. You trained by lifting, so you know they got paid to do it, and you know you only hear about the big names, but there were many other you know strongmen that would hang around the pubs and the taverns and bars and stuff like that, and there was gambling to be done. You know, people would bet on who was the strongest and so on. But that's essentially how it was. It wasn't complicated. You know, there were no sets. There were no, there was no, how should I say, mechanical equipment. You know, you have machines nowadays. There was a machine maker called Zander. His last name was Zander. And he made equipment back in the 19th century. Very few pieces have survived. But, yeah, he was a mechanical genius, and he came up with the equipment. But again, it was nowhere to be found, and there were very few gyms in the early 20th century. You know, most of them would be, for example, in New York, on the along the East Coast. There was nothing on the West Coast.
Yeah, I know that these things evolved, you know, very slowly, and the training was very specialized, as you said, and it was mostly for entertainment. They did earn their money doing these things, and so there were expectations, and a lot of people don't know that the superhero costumes, the whole concept, was based on these wrestlers and strongmen of old. Like Superman wearing like, his underwear outside his tights and his having a colorful cape. That's a direct copy of these wrestlers and strongmen. You know, they used to dress very flamboyantly, and we wouldn't have superheroes without them.
No. That's exactly right. We'd have costumes. The costumes would be taken from, for example, acrobats, tumblers and stuff like that. They would wear the tights, and you know, and they would wear the one strap affair across the chest, and that would also evolve from say back in the day with the Greek and Roman togas, you know, a gladiator warfare like that, the gladiator sandals. You see occasionally Sandow made those popular. Sigmund Klein had a pair. I saw his when I visited him. Even when I talked to Klein, he said, the training back then was very, very simple. It wasn't complicated, you know, but it was progressive. That was the whole key, just like it is today. If it's not progressive, you're naturally not going to progress. You're going
right.
to stay at a particular weight, say it's press or deadlift or whatever. It would, unless you add either weight, resistance, repetitions, sets, or cut the time.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to progress to any great extent.
Yeah, those are the basics, and as you said, they haven't changed since the days of Milo of Croton in ancient Greece. He
mm-hmm.
picked up a calf one day, and then he picked it up the next day, and then he picked it up the next day, and each day he was able to lift it and perform a few exercises. He didn't change his routine, but the calf kept getting heavier and heavier until it was a bull.
Yeah.
And then he was lifting a bull every day. And it said that when he finished his routine with the bull, he ate it. So.
Yes, I was just about to say that. That was that was part of it. Interesting enough, though, I'm not saying it didn't happen, okay, but
mm-hmm.
his progression was very fast because those bulls grow very quickly. You know, you're not
right.
talking just a pound a day, you know, especially a calf, you know, anywhere near his mother, you know, getting milk and what have you, they'll grow very quickly. But, yeah, that's basically the to training, you know. And the same way, like I said, with dietary regime is availability. Okay, what was available? That's the key. You know, the Roman soldiers, okay, they would eat, they would carry food, okay, most of it dry, and they would speculate as to where they were going and what food would be available. Occasionally they would add meat if it was available, okay, to their diet. And they made something called what I refer to as gruel.
Yeah.
And what it was like a wheat paste. They would wear, they had a belt, and they would have various pockets, you know, around the belt, and they would carry wheat, okay, and they would mix it with water. You know, this is during times when there was no food, okay, so they would rely. This is like their plan B or their backup plan. You know,
mm-hmm.
so they had a very, and no pun intended, a cow or something, or, you know, chickens or some other type of, you know, poultry or something like that. And so they would, you know, they would eat in that manner. Genghis Khan, interesting. I don't know if you're familiar with a restaurant chain called the Mongolian Barbecue.
Yes.
I don't know if you have that. Okay, you're familiar with that. Okay,
yeah.
that is the form of cooking that the Mongolians did, and what they cooked in was their shields.
Yes,
they would flip their shields over, and again, you know, rice was a big deal, and in Mongolia, in China, what have you, in Asia, and so that was, you know, rice over there is like potatoes here, you know. Or like pasta is in Italy, okay? And when you are in a particular, you know, the food and eating is very territorial. It's a matter of geography. For example, if you live in Japan, you're surrounded with water. What's in water? Fish. So they eat a lot of seafood, not just fish, but other, you know, sea creatures. And of course, rice and stuff like that. And of course, you know, a fish is predominantly a better, a healthier food than, for example, red meat, beef or what have you. But here in the United States, it's beef. What do with these? Well, we can make wine. So they drink
right.
wine. You know, wine is a big deal there. Are you going to go to Italy and order a glass of milk? Of course not. you know, it's not how it is. And, you know, tomatoes and peppers and cheeses and stuff like that. And, you know, Germany, you have beer. Belgium, you have beer, you know. And that is something that has to be kept in mind. You know, it's based on availability. Food is based on availability, tradition. You know, historically, people will celebrate certain holidays. They'll have turkey or they'll have ham. You know, and you know, stuff like that. But with the ancient people, this is how they lived, and you know, today people can't fathom that, you know, because today you go to the store and you buy it, you know, not going to go fishing.
I was growing up in Greece, they still went out and supplemented their diet by fishing or catching crabs or oysters and clams, you know, whatever. It was an island. So in addition to going to work and getting money and buying things at stores, you grew your own stuff either in your backyard or if you had some property, you grew stuff. You might raise chickens and have fresh eggs and fish, because you're on an island. People would just fish, you know. On Sunday, they go fish for the week, and whatever they caught, that's what they would have throughout the week. And there were ice boxes back then, not refrigerators. You had to go get the ice every couple of days and put it in the ice box. And when it melted, you had cold water, and then everything kept cold. Very, very different.
My grandmother and grandfather had an ice box. It was oak, and there was a wall on the outside wall had this door, and the door was about 2 by 3 feet. Anyway, it was a small door, and the door was, because it didn't go all the way to the floor, you know, all the way to the floor of the porch, and it's on the outside. I looked at that, and when I went inside, you know, I was about 8 years old. I would look. I tried to figure out where that door was going, but there was a refrigerator there, a modern-day refrigerator, electric, you know. So I asked my Nana one day. I said, "Nana, what is that door for on the outside?" And so she walked outside there, and she opened up the door, and there was, like, tar paper and insulation there. And she said, "This is the door. Before we had a refrigerator, we had an icebox. And the icebox would, every day or every few days, the iceman would come."
Yes.
"And he would put a block of ice in there." And I was fascinated with that. I couldn't understand that, you know. And that's how they kept, you know, we'll do today. They did a lot of canning. Or certain people say in this country, I think in the South, putting up jars of tomatoes or jars of pickles or whatever. They put them up, which means canning. And I helped even back in the 50s, I helped my grandparents and my parents do canning. You know, they would, you know, boil the water and boil whatever they were going to. You know, put in the jars, and then they would pour paraffin, which is like a waxy type stuff.
The wax, yeah.
Yeah, that would seal it, and then you put the lid on. And it was my job to carry these jars in a box down the stairs into the basement, or in your part of the country, it's called a cellar.
The root cellar.
Below ground level.
Yeah.
Root cellars. And when the temperature is always be cool down there, see? And they had a lot of shelving in there, and it was my job to take it down there and put all this stuff on the shelves. And we would work on this for days, and we would can hundreds of jars of fruits and vegetables, you know. And you know, that's what people did back then. You know, it wasn't a matter of going. You didn't have supermarkets. You might have a general store, you know. And another thing that was interesting. At Christmas time, my grandmother would always put an orange in my Christmas stocking. And I was a kid. I said, "Well, what's this, an orange? What's the big deal?" Well, Mike Simone, You didn't get an orange anytime you wanted it, see? And when they did have refrigeration in the 30s, okay, it was used, one of the first uses was on refrigeration cars and railroads. So they could bring the oranges from Florida up to the northern states, see?
Mm-hmm.
So when you went to the market or whatever, when you got the oranges, you know, you would eat them right away, other than putting them in the ice box, you know. So, you know, it was just things like that. And also, before refrigeration, to preserve meat, you would dry it.
Yes.
Or in some cases, you would salt it, like hams. You know, you have what they call fresh pork, and you have ham. Ham is pork that has been preserved, you know,
right,
through the salt process. There's like a rind on the outside of the ham. That's peeled away, of course, when you eat it. But, you know, these were things that were done. You know, we had the victory gardens. Everybody had a garden, you know, because it was tough times coming out of the Great Depression. You know,
mm-hmm.
Everybody would have a garden, and they would have their fresh food, and again, they would can it and what have you. But again, the old-time strongmen lived during these times where availability in the food ranks was key, and they didn't have the preservatives and the stuff like that. They ate hearty meals, you know, and their training was, like I say, took a long time. You know, it wasn't just an hour a day. They trained, like the Saxon brothers, who were performers. If they didn't have a show, many times they had a show two or three times a day. If they didn't, they would lift, you know, on their off days or what have you. And they trained every day. There wasn't this off day stuff, because in many cases they had performances. And then if they didn't have a performance, they would train. But I just found it fascinating. You know, there wasn't any, you know, deep dark secrets or special way of doing things. It was just a way of life. It's like the old wrestlers, the same way. You know, they would wrestle, and you know, because it keeps them in shape.
That's very true. I like the retro stuff, but sometimes the advice is not the best for modern people. Like, for instance, I think I pushed myself into diabetes by following pre-steroid bodybuilding dietary advice. I started drinking phenomenal amounts of milk, because that was recommended, to try to drink like a gallon of milk a day. And I was lactose intolerant, so I had to build up a tolerance, and then I had to keep increasing the amounts. And also, they recommended eating a lot of citrus fruit, like oranges.
Yeah.
So I would eat like half dozen oranges a day. And I must tell you, it worked, and it worked really fast. But then it started crashing after a while, and it crashed really fast as well. I lost all those big muscles very, very quickly, like I put them on very, very quickly. So as with anything else, you know, proceed at your peril. But so much of the advice that they pass down is, I still find it very useful. Like with everything else we've talked about, it works for a while, and then it seems to kind of peter out and doesn't work as well. And you got to look to find something different to replace it, because your body adjusts fairly quickly. But these guys had a different aesthetic. You know, now we have the superheroes to compare our bodybuilders and our wrestlers and our performers to. Then they didn't. You know, they had the classic statuary of Greece and Rome, and they had their own, you know, concepts of what strength looks like. And they manifested and embodied and expressed those ideas. And it's very interesting to watch the images evolve throughout time. Like, for a while, it seemed like having a mustache, a handlebar mustache, was part of the deal of being a strong man. and the types of clothing that you described that are based on the toga and made of animal skin and over tights and so forth. So the book is like phenomenally fascinating in that it chronicles that, and you see how ideas change. And for us who grew up during the Peplum era, the idea was like Steve Reeves, Reg Park, and so on. And now, you know, we've passed Schwarzenegger and Ferrigno, and now we have the human body redefined into something totally different that I don't think it goes beyond what anybody, I think, in the past would have striven for.
Yeah. Interesting. I don't know if you can actually... I don't know what causes diabetes. I really couldn't tell you. I've known very, very skinny people that have it. I've known people that are very heavy that have it. There's type 1 diabetes, and there's type 2 diabetes.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if you can, if there's any behavior that can cause it. I don't know that much about it.
Dietary, carbohydrates, especially sugars, your body becomes resistant to them, and they start eating away at your body. There's different, even with type 2 diabetes, there's so many different ways of looking at it that it becomes a quest. Like right now, I'm trying out berberine and bitter melon. There's a lot of information, some anecdotal and some actual studies that show that these things help. So having tried fibers and having tried different types of vitamins and having tried different types of diets, and again, they work for a while and then till the day they don't, and then you got to do something different. So I look at these things. I mean, I have them. I'm trying to minimize the effect of them. But everyone has challenges, so life has given me these. So I'm gonna challenge myself to see if I can make things better in different ways based on what I learn and seeing what the effects of that are and keeping track of it. There's really not that much I can do. Experts can't even agree how much protein a bodybuilder needs or how much carbohydrate. So it's the same thing with diabetes. You have different experts with different qualifications that are very similar, claiming contradictory things. So not having a medical degree or not having gone to school to study this, it all boils down to who do you believe and how badly do you believe what they have to say.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. You know, that's to me, that's, you know, that's fascinating. How you bring yourself out of that, as far as the diabetes, I really don't know, and I don't know if they'll ever have a cure for it. You know, I think it's where the pancreas gland fails or whatever. I think that's what it is. You no longer can process simple sugars.
I look at diabetes like my Hydra. In Greek mythology, Hercules had the Hydra, which was the snake of many heads. And every time you cut off a head, two would grow in its place until you find the root of it. And then he cut off the main head and he burned the stumps of the other heads that he killed and defeated the Hydra. Then he took the Hydra's venom because it was highly poisonous and used it in his adventures. But it was the Hydra venom that killed him in the end. So, yeah, you have that story in the future. So right now, diabetes is my Hydra. And I could only do my best based on what I learn and what I know and how well I can apply it.
Yeah, that's true. That's very, very true.
Go ahead.
Yes. I've known many people that have had diabetes to some extent. Some can control it by diet, some by pills, and you know, of course, some by needle. I've only known one person that went from being on the needle to eliminating diabetes altogether, and this individual had a one of those stomach bypass affairs, you know, and he lost a, I was going to say a ton of weight, but I think you understand. He lost, oh gosh, I'd have to say 150 pounds at least. And he didn't have to take insulin. I found that interesting.
Yeah, I haven't had to take, I've had diabetes for over 10 years now, and I haven't had to be on insulin. What I do is the medications that they give you for it, like metformin, it's been shown time and again. It's kind of like the best thing they've got to give you, but it's been shown time and again that it leads to harder medications. It leads to some conditions. You know, it's a gift with a price. So what I've been doing is I cycle it. So I'll take it for a while, then I'll stop and let my body take care of it to the best of the ability. And then if my body is showing again that it's not handling it on its own, then I'll go back and take it. And I've been doing this for like a decade now because some of the conditions that you can get from some of these medicines are, I think, worse than the diabetes that they're trying to help you control.
Yeah, yeah. You're getting a treat or a treatment, you know. Sometimes the treatment is worse than the disease. That's true.
Yeah, I remember taking one medicine that was prescribed, and I looked at the I looked online at the things it can cause, and one of the top things was can cause sudden death. So guess what? I stopped taking right away.
yeah. The first symptom is death. Yeah. That would get your attention.
Yep. And I remember, like, when I was growing up, medicine, my parents did take me to the doctor on occasion. Most of the times it was chamomile for stomach-related stuff, warm ginger ale for, like, heavy-duty stomach-related stuff. It was, sage, mountain sage, they call it, for like more serious stuff than chamomile could handle. And then there were the cups, Venduzis. They used to put alcohol and cotton and then put it in like a cup and then put the cup on your back, and the cup drew out all the ill humors that were plaguing you. And I know that's, except for like some alternate medicine or new age type of practices, that's not considered medicine anymore. But back when I was growing up, that was it. You know, the herbs didn't work. Now we'll take out the cups, and the cups will do it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting.
And I wonder what they'll be saying about the things we're doing in 50 years from now, how barbaric they'll consider medicine.
That's a tough call, because, you know, we're doing stuff today that we would smile about back in the 60s, like, for example, the flip-top phone, Star Trek, 1966 when it came out. Everybody saw that flip-top phone, and they thought, wow, isn't that something, you know? Well, we're beyond the flip-top phone. And I remember the comics in the 50s with Dick Tracy. He had the wristwatch.
Yes.
Know, where he had, well, we've got those now. You know, we have the walkie-talkie affair or phone, wrist phone, you know. My grandmother in the early part of the 20th century, in the teens and the 20s, and especially in like the 30s, they would see Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon in the movies. And they would have the big picture on the wall, and it was like a TV, what we have today. And they would laugh about that. They would say, that'll never happen. Well, we've got exactly that now. We have something where we don't have the heavy TVs anymore, the big bulky, huge cube. We have a flat screen that hangs on the wall. And weighs next to nothing, you know, by comparison.
A lot of those kids who grew up on that, they went out and created it. They've interviewed them, and books have been written that where they got the inspiration was the TV shows that you're talking about. They grew up with them, and when they got into science or whatever, they try and figure out how to make them, and they did.
You can conceive and you can achieve. That's how it is. give somebody a target, and they'll do that. You know, rocket ship to the moon was another one. My grandmother used to laugh about that. Well, 1969, we evidently put a man on the moon.
Yep.
So where will we be in 50 years? Oh, gosh. As far as nutrition, it's difficult to say. We have a world situation where, you know, we're getting more and more people. Although I read the other day where China's population is dropping. They're having a problem with it because the Chinese don't want to have a lot of children. But, you know, for years, China was concerned about too many people, and they put a limit on how many people you can have. You know, they only have one. And then go back even further, if you have children, they would genocide the females. They would kill the female babies. You know, not a very nice approach. But
no.
So I don't know. I often think about that. Where will we be? What have you? Well, there's no more bodybuilding contests to really speak of. There's only maybe three or four. And there's no magazines. Olympic weightlifting, I think the next one is the last for Olympic weightlifting. They've eliminated that from the Olympics. Yeah.
I wasn't aware of that. Why did they do that?
Well, I have read with other sports, not just the Olympic weightlifting, I have read it's a matter of economics like everything else. I don't know why people do things, follow the money, of course, but popularity. You have to understand, majority of people, when I say majority, it's well above 90% of the people in this country have never lifted any weights, much less Olympic lifting. They think that, you know, if they watch it on the television, they'll see, you know, these big guys, in many cases, the heavyweights, do it. They think it's strength. No, it's not strength entirely. You can have somebody that is a seasoned weightlifter. They lift weights. They're very strong. Not Olympic lifting. They lift weights. They're very strong, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But if you take the competition and you train them to a particular lift, you know, it's a total act of body coordination. The entire body is involved with that lift. It's a quick lift, okay? And people can't relate to it. If you go to a gym and you want to learn how to lift Olympic style, the coach is going to give you a broom handle in many cases for weeks and weeks and weeks until you get your form down. It's like learning a golf swing.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask somebody or tell them you want to learn how to play golf, the first thing they'll tell you is get a pro to show you how, because if you try to do it yourself, immediately you're going to develop bad habits. And a bad habit takes a while, any habit at all takes a while to really ingrain it in your psyche and your everyday living. It takes like months, okay? And then it's locked in. It becomes second nature. Well, you don't want to develop a bad habit because it's hard as hell to break it, okay?
Yeah.
And the same thing with Olympic lifting. But like I say, the average individual, and it's only two lifts. You know, can you imagine what swimming would be like? You know, Olympic swimming, if there was only two events, or track and field. Well, we just have two events.
Yeah.
See, wrestling is on the bubble, too. Wrestling had better be careful.
Okay.
Well, the girls are wearing next to nothing. I can see the attraction there. It wouldn't make any difference what the sport was. But now you have, they added the skateboard. Isn't that skateboard is on the Olympics now?
Is it? I used to do a lot of Olympic related stuff, and I used to get lots of emails. I still get them, but I don't really have a chance to go over them as much. So it seems like I missed a lot.
But Olympic lifting, weightlifting, it all started out in 1896. They just had, I think it was 1896. I think it was the first year. Definitely by the second Olympics, they had, it was just lifting a dumbbell. That was it. I don't think it was even on the major list of Olympic lifts. But it grew in popularity, and at one point there were five lifts in one year. I think it was 1928, off the top of my head. And they had five lifts, and that was the only Olympics that they had five lifts. But it was one of the original sports. And
yeah.
So was wrestling, you know, one of the original sports. But again, it's all about viewing time. You know, people want to see it and what have you. People that still practice Olympic weightlifting. The sad thing about it is, in many cases, you'll see CrossFit. They'll do some of the Olympic lifts, and they're not trained properly, you can hurt yourself.
Right.
Because they're practicing the lift against the clock. Everything about CrossFit is, you know, by the stopwatch. And unless you know what you're doing, you can really injure yourself with that. But that's their business. I don't criticize. At least they're getting up off the couch and leaving the cell phone on the table, you know. I give them credit for that. 20 years from now, 50 years, oh, God, I can't imagine what things will be like in 50 years. But, you know, look how things have changed the last 20 years. Did you ever think society would be the way it is today 20 years ago? I know I didn't.
I didn't either.
But, you know, this is what people want. We are gradually, you know, within the last 100 years, drifting away from any type of physical, you know, serious physical work. You know, we have machines to do a lot of this stuff, and the necessity for manufacturing, especially in this country, is gone because we seem to think we want to, you know, send it all offshore. So, you know, do people today, most people or anybody that you know, do they do any hard physical labor? Not by comparison.
No.
You know, especially compared to 50 years ago. While you have the separation, you have the what they call the white collar and the blue collar, you know. Many of the blue collar jobs today require skill to make any type of income, a skilled trade of some type. But even that, over time, does not provide enough activity to develop muscle. There's an epidemic, speaking of diabetes, you have an epidemic in this country with school-age kids. Diabetes is becoming rampant. And
yes.
Obesity, you know, because the kids don't go outdoors in the summer. When I was a kid, we didn't have any of these fields, you know, ball fields and stuff like that. Today, I'll drive by a school, and there'll be a ball field, like in July, and it's beautiful outside, and there's not a kid there. Nobody. My pals and me would have killed to have a place like that to play. We usually played in an open where you're stumbling around on rocks and tree stumps and everything else, and you know, everything was pickup. You know, if you had a glove, if somebody had a bat and a ball, you're in business, you know.
There you go, baseball.
Yeah, we used to play in the streets, and I'm sure you're familiar with that, being in in New York, you know, street type stuff. Baseball is a big thing in New York, you know. But, that's how it is. I don't know. Sports in this country have become a observation activity. You watch. You don't do it. You watch it, you know. And it's very expensive to go to a game, a professional game anyway. Even the college games are getting expensive. And you know, for kids to play on a team, you know, the emphasis on winning, not necessarily participating. I think it should be based on participation. Get as many people out there as you can to participate in the game. You know, whatever it is, I think sports ought to be mandatory. Somebody that is going to school, a kid that's going to school, should participate in an after-school sport. It doesn't make any difference what it is. I don't care what it is, but it's a physical activity, you know. And in many cases, I think it's good to expose them to it because they may not know that they really like the game. They may discover they love doing it. So, you know, you have that involved too. And there's all sorts of sports that they could be involved in. But that's not how it is. Physical activity is not promoted in this country. Therefore, you know, I'm not saying force people, but I think that you know, it should be available to them, and they should participate. You know, but that's just my point of view. Otherwise, you're going to have many of these sports just die on the vine.
That would be a shame because.
I
was never a big sports person aside from weightlifting and. But I tried a lot of sports. I tried volleyball.
Yeah.
I had an aptitude for that. Basketball, I wasn't on the A team, but I had an aptitude for that. Baseball, I found very boring, although my son loved it, my eldest son, when he was growing up. I tried football. I tried all the different sports, horseback riding, canoeing. I got to experiment with all those things. And again, some I liked, some I didn't like. The ones I liked, I did. The ones I didn't like, I didn't do. But there was always the opportunity to explore the physical activity. And I enjoyed having those options, and I took advantage of them.
Absolutely. You know, especially the sports where, you know, consider lifetime sports, you know. It could be golf. It could be bowling. It could be, you know, something like that rather than, you know, football. You know, how many people suit up for football after high school? You know, not
mm-hmm.
many.
Teams. People had, like, amateur teams. Like, with bowling, I remember. Much of my life in places I've worked, people would invite me to the bowling club. You know, there were bowling clubs, there were things like that. There was a softball, basketball. But you're right, I haven't really heard anybody talking about that or offering that in a very long time. I hadn't even thought of it.
Yeah. That's interesting.
It reminds me of there's a gentleman, I interviewed him recently, and he talks about like 19th century and early 20th century exercises. He's made a few YouTube videos. And it seems like those clubs were a very important part of our, like, not ancient or medieval history, but a part of our modern history. And they seem to be gone. I don't recall the last time, although I know that they're YMCAs. I don't remember seeing promotions for things happening at the YMCA for a while. I remember when I was growing up as a kid, they were everywhere, signs to sign up for this or sign up for that. Or, you know, there was always something that you could do at a local YMCA.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very true. you know, people, like I said, they were more, they would send us boys outside, hey, you're not staying in here today, it's a beautiful day in the summertime, you know, and you came home and the streetlights were on, you know.
Uh-huh. My wife was talking about how our parents used to kick her out. Go outside.
Yeah.
How do you play outside?
Yeah, that's true.
But we have super strength training. You have done more than most individuals on this planet to preserve these arts that are now slowly being lost. So we have to thank you for that. And you've acquired and maintain quite a catalog of things, you know, books, DVDs, and all sorts of media. So thank you for doing that.
Oh, you're very welcome. Yeah, I've done it for a long time, well over 50 years.
Yep. And the catalogs are some, even if you're not into exercise, if you're into retro things, the catalogs are a wonder to behold. And I'm sure that they're collectibles at this point.
Oh, yeah, yeah. A lot of people collect them.
Yeah, I have a bunch of them. So I look at my my podcast efforts, and I hope I'm doing the same thing, helping preserve these ancient arts, whether from actual antiquity or, relatively speaking, newer antiquity. And I keep asking myself, you know, what more can I do? How can I do this more effectively?
Yeah.
And given the wide range of your products, I'm sure you ask yourself the same questions. Do you have any ideas for how we can help shape and preserve these things for another 50 years?
Well, you're going to the digital age, okay? I think we'll always have paper and ink books, pamphlets, or what have you. But the digital properties, you know, they seem to be very popular as of right now. And that can change. You never know.
I think it will.
You never know. It could go, you know, to the paper and ink again. I don't know. It's difficult to say, you know. Things have progressed in that area, too, in the last 50 years. But I try to keep the information out there, again, availability, it's there. If you want to read about it, if you want to take your hand at it, I tell people you'll never know unless you experiment with it. You'll learn. Either you like it or you don't like it. You either get results or you didn't get results. But if you don't do it, and the worst thing is to have a regret where you look back and say, you know, I might have done something with that. I might have been very good at that, but you never tried it.
Very wise words. And where can people go to hear more wise words and have access to your catalog? And I recommend to everybody, get the newsletter. The newsletter comes and it's full of Bill's wisdom and also links you up to all sorts of things that you might have not even known still existed.
The best thing to do is go on the Internet and enter superstrengthtraining.com. My website will pop up, and you'll see usually up in the upper right-hand corner, there'll be a little box that says, it asks for your name and your email address, and enter that, and you'll be added to my newsletter. I have tens of thousands of people that read my newsletters, and I send them out just about every day. It's always something of interest. Either about an old nutrition, about an exercise, a piece of equipment, what has happened recently, biographies of old-time strongmen. There's just a number of things. They're very enjoyable, very popular. A lot of people love them. A lot of people contribute. You know, I have something to say, which I always welcome. You know, give me ideas, something to do and what have you. And through my website, and you can check it out. The various publications that I have, that also has a lot of interesting information. And you can order my catalog if you like that. And if you order something, order a book or a course or whatever, I send a free catalog along.
So you can start your collection just as I've started my collection.
Absolutely.
I personally think the digital stuff won't last forever because when many years ago, when Kindles first came out, my son got me a Kindle.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started finding books that I had at home that took up a lot of space, and I would put them on the Kindle. And I had thousands of books inside my Kindle. But I started getting rid of the hard copy books because I had them on my Kindle. And then one day something happened to my Kindle, and it blocked me off from all the thousands of books that I had. And I couldn't access them anymore, and I didn't have them in physical copies, a lot of them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And they were hard to get. So now I got them, most of them back, and I still have things on the Kindle, but if the Kindle disappears, it's okay, because the ones that really matter, I have an hard copy.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Bill, as always. I've missed talking to you. I look forward to our next conversation. You're awesome. Keep doing the great things you're doing.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure. Anything I can do to help out, Hercules. Take care of yourself until the next time.
Until the next time. And to everyone who's listening, thank you very much. Until next time, joyous journeys and amazing adventures to everyone. Thanks again, Bill.
You're very welcome. Take care, my friend.